The Eagle's Shadow by James Branch Cabell. 6. On the way to luncheon, Mr. Woods came upon Adele Haggage and Hugh Van Orden, both of whom he knew, very much engrossed in one another, in a nook under the stairway. To Billy it seemed just now quite proper that everyone should be in love. Wasn't it, after all, the most pleasant condition in the world? So he greeted them with a semi-paternal smile that caused Adele to flush a little. For she was, let us say, interested in Mr. Van Orden. That was tolerably well known. In fact, Margaret, prompted by Mrs. Haggage, it must be confessed, had invited him to Selwood for the especial purpose of entertaining Miss Adele Haggage. For he was a good match, and Mrs. Haggage, as an experienced chaperone, knew the value of country houses. Very unexpectedly, however, the boy had developed a disconcerting tendency to fall in love with Margaret, who snubbed him promptly and unmercifully. He had accordingly fallen back on Adele, and Mrs. Haggage had regained both her trust in Providence and her temper. In the breakfast room, where luncheon was laid out, the Colonel greeted Mr. Woods with the enthusiasm a sailor shipwrecked on a desert island might conceivably display toward the boat crew come to rescue him. The Colonel liked Billy, and furthermore, the poor Colonel's position at Selwood just now was not utterly unlike that of the supposititious mariner. Were I minded to venture into metaphor, I should picture him as clinging desperately to the rock of an old fogyism, and surrounded by weltering seas of advanced thought. Colonel Hugonin himself was not advanced in his ideas. Also, he had forceful opinions as to the ultimate destination of those who were. Then Billy was presented to the men of the party, Mr. Felix Canaston and Mr. Petheridge Jukesbury. Mrs. Haggage he knew slightly, and Kathleen Saumarez he had known very well indeed some 6 years previously, before she had ever heard of Miguel Saumarez, and when Billy was still an undergraduate. She was a widow now, and not well-to-do, and Mr. Woods's first thought on seeing her was that a man was a fool to write verses, and that she looked like just the sort of woman to preserve them. His second was that he had verged on imbecility when he had fancied he admired that slender, dark-haired type. A woman's hair ought to be an enormous coronal of sunlight. A woman ought to have very large, candid eyes, of a color between that of sapphires and that of the spring heavens, only infinitely more beautiful than either. And all petticoated persons, differing from this description, were manifestly quite unworthy of any serious consideration. So his eyes turned to Margaret, who had no eyes for him. She had forgotten his existence, with an utterness that verged on ostentation. And if it had been anyone else, Billy would have surmised she was in a temper. But that angel in a temper? Nonsense! And oh, what eyes she had, and what lashes, and what hair! And altogether, how adorable she was, and what a wonder the admiring gods hadn't snatched her up to Olympus long ago. Thus far, Mr. Woods. But if Miss Hugonin was somewhat taciturn, her counselors in diverse schemes for benefiting the universe were an opulent vein. Billy heard them silently. "I have spent the entire morning by the lake," Mr. Canaston informed the party at large, "in company with a mockingbird who was practicing a new aria. It was a wonderful place. The trees were lisping verses to themselves, and the sky overhead was like a robin's egg in color, and a faint wind was making tucks and ruches and pleats all over the water, quite as if the breezes had set up in business as mantua makers. I fancy they thought they were working on a great sheet of blue silk, for it was very like that, and every once in a while a fish would leap and leave a splurge of bubble and foam behind that you would have sworn was an inserted lace medallion." Mr. Canaston, as you are doubtless aware, is the author of The King's Quest and other volumes of verse. He's a full-bodied young man with hair of no particular shade, and if his green eyes are a little aged, his manner is very youthful. His voice in speaking is wonderfully pleasing, and he has a habit of cocking his head on one side in a bird-like fashion.
"Indeed," Mr. Petheridge Jukesbury observed, "it is very true that God made the country and man made the town. A little more wine, please."
Mr. Jukesbury is a prominent worker in the cause of philanthropy and temperance. He is ponderous and bland, and for the rest, he is president of the Society
for the suppression of nicotine and the nude, vice president of the Anti-Inebriation League, secretary of the Incorporated Brotherhood of Benevolence, and the bearer of diverse similar honors.
I am never really very happy in the country, Mrs. Somers dissented. It reminds me so constantly of our rural drama. I'm always afraid the quartet may come on and sing something.
Kathleen Epps Somers, as I hope you do not need to be told, is the well-known lecturer before women's clubs, and the author of many sympathetic stories of nature and animal life, of the kind that have had such a vogue of late. There was always an indefinable air of pathos about her. As Hunson Wick put it, one felt somehow that her mother had been of a domineering disposition, and that she took after her father.
"Ah, dear lady," Mr. Kynaston cried playfully, "you, like many of us, have become an alien to nature in your quest of a mere earthly paradox. Epigrams are all very well, but I fancy there is more happiness to be derived from a single impulse, from a vernal wood, than from a whole problem play of smart sayings. So few of us are natural," Mr. Kynaston complained with a dulcet sigh. "We are too sophisticated. Our very speech lacks the tang of outdoor life. Why should we not love nature, the great mother who is, I grant you, the necessity of various useful inventions in her angry moods, but who, in her kindly moments," he paused with a wry face.
"I beg your pardon," said he, "but I believe I've caught rheumatism lying by that confounded pond." Mrs. Somers rallied the poet with a pale smile.
"That comes of communing with nature," she reminded him, "and it serves you rightly, for natural communications corrupt good epigrams. I prefer nature with wide margins and uncut leaves."
She spoke in her best platform manner.
"Odd should be an expurgated edition of nature, with all the unpleasant parts left out. And I am sure," Mrs. Somers added, handsomely and clinching her argument, "that Mr. Kynaston gives us much better sunsets in his poems than I have ever seen in the West."
He acknowledged this with a bow.
"Not sherry, claret, if you please," said Mr. Jukesbury. "Art should be an expurgated edition of nature," he repeated with a suave chuckle. "Do you know, I consider that admirably put, Mrs. Somers. Admirably, upon my word. Ah, if our latter-day writers would only take that saying to heart. We do not need to be told of the vice and corruption prevalent, I am sorry to say, among the very best people. What we really need is continually to be reminded of the fact that pure hearts and homes and happy faces are to be found today alike in the palatial residences of the wealthy and in the humbler homes of those less abundantly favored by fortune. And yet, dwelling together in harmony and Christian resignation and, comparatively moderate circumstances."
"Surely," Mrs. Somers protested, "art has nothing to do with morality. Art is a process. You see a thing in a certain way. You make your reader see it in the same way, or try to. If you succeed, the result is art. If you fail, it may be the book of the year."
"Enduring immortality and, the patronage of the reading public," Mr. Jukesbury placidly insisted, "will be awarded in the end only to those who dwell upon the true, the beautiful, and the, respectable. Art must cheer. It must be optimistic and edifying and, suitable for young persons. It must have an uplift, a leaven of righteousness, a sort of moral baking powder. It must utterly eschew the, unpleasant and repugnant details of life. It is, if I may so express myself, not at home in the ménage à trois, or, the representation of the nude. Yes, another glass of claret, if you please."
"I quite agree with you," said Mrs. Haggage in her deep voice. Sarah Ellen Haggage is, of course, the well-known author of Child Labor in the South and The Downtrodden Afro-American and other notable contributions to literature. She is also the Madam President both of the Society for the Betterment of Civic Government and Sewerage and of the Ladies League for the Edification of the Impecunious.
"And I am glad to see," Mrs. Haggage presently went on, "that the literature of the day is so largely beginning to chronicle the sayings and doings of the laboring classes. The virtues of the humble must be admitted in spite of their dissolute and unhygienic tendencies. Yes, Mrs. Haggage added meditatively, our literature is undoubtedly acquiring a more elevated tone. At last we are shaking off the scintillant and unwholesome influence of the French.
Ah, the French, sighed Mr. Kynaston, a people who think depravity the soul of wit. Their art is mere artfulness. They care nothing for nature.
No, Mrs. Haggage assented. They prefer nastiness. All French books are immoral. I ran across one the other day that was simply hideously indecent, unfit for a modest woman to read. And I can assure you that none of its author's other books are any better. I purchased the entire set at once and read them carefully, in order to make sure that I was perfectly justified in warning my working girls' classes against them. I wish to misjudge no man, not even a member of a nation notoriously devoted to absinthe and illicit relations. She breathed heavily, and looked at Mr. Woods as if somehow he was responsible. Then she gave the name of the book to Petheridge Jukesbury. He wished to have it placed on the Index Expurgatorius of the Brotherhood of Benevolence, he said. Dear, dear, Felix Kynaston sighed, as Mr. Jukesbury made a note of it. You are all so practical. You perceive an evil and proceed at once, in your common sense way, to crush it, to stamp it out. Now I can merely lament certain unfortunate tendencies of the age. I am quite unable to contend against them. Do you know, Mr. Kynaston continued gaily as he trifled with a bunch of grapes, I feel horribly out of place among you. Here is Mrs. Saumarez, creating an epidemic of useful and improving knowledge throughout the country by means of her charming lectures. Here is Mrs. Haggage, the mainspring, if I may say so, of any number of educational and philanthropic alarm clocks, which will some day rouse the sleeping public from its lethargy. And here is my friend Jukesbury, whose eloquent pleas for a higher life have turned so many workmen from gin and improvidence, and which in a printed form are disseminated even in such remote regions as Africa, where I am told they have produced the most satisfactory results upon the unsophisticated but polygamous monarchs of that continent. And here, above all, is Miss Hugonin, utilizing the vast power of money, which I am credibly informed is a very good thing to have, though I cannot pretend to speak from experience, and casting whole bakeryfuls of bread upon the waters of charity. And here am I, the idle singer of an empty day, a mere drone in this hive of philanthropic bees. Dear, dear, said Mr. Kynaston enviously, what a thing it is to be practical. And he laughed toward Margaret in his whimsical way. Miss Hugonin had been strangely silent, but she returned Mr. Kynaston's smile and began to take part in the conversation. You're only an ignorant child, she rebuked him. And a very naughty child, too, to make fun of us in this fashion. Yes, Mr. Kynaston assented. I am willfully ignorant. The world adores ignorance, and where ignorance is kissed, it is folly to be wise. Tomorrow I shall read you a chapter from my Defense of Ignorance, which my confiding publisher is going to bring out in the autumn. So the table talk went on, and now Margaret bore a part therein. However, I do not think we need record it further. Mr. Woods listened in a sort of daze. Adele Haggage and Hugh Van Orden were conversing in low tones at one end of the table. The colonel was eating his luncheon, silently and with a certain air of resignation, so Billy Woods was left alone to attend and marvel. The ideas they advanced seemed to him, for the most part, sensible. What puzzled him was the uniform gravity which they accorded equally, as it appeared to him, to the discussion of the most pompous platitudes and of the most arrant nonsense. They were always serious. In the general tone of infallibility, Billy thought, could be warranted only by a vast fund of inexperience. But in the main, they advocated theories he had always held. Excellent theories, he considered, and he was seized with an unreasonable desire to repudiate every one of them. For it seemed to him that every one of them was aimed at Margaret's approval. It did not matter to whom a remark was ostensibly addressed. Always at its conclusion, the speaker glanced more or less openly toward Miss Hugonin. She was the audience to which they zealously played, thought Billy, and he wondered. I think I have said that, owing to the smallness of the house party, luncheon was served in the breakfast room.
The dining room at Selwood is very rarely used because Margaret declares its size makes a meal there equivalent to eating out of doors. And I must confess that the breakfast room is far cozier. The room in the first place is of reasonable dimensions. It is hung with Flemish tapestries from designs by Van Eyck, representing the four seasons. But the walls and ceilings are paneled in oak, and over the mantel carved in bas relief, the inevitable eagle is displayed. The mantel stood behind Margaret's chair, and over her golden head, half protestingly, half threateningly, with its wings outstretched to the uttermost, the eagle brooded as he had once brooded over Frederick R. Woods. The old man sat contentedly beneath that symbol of what he had achieved in life. He had started, as the phrase runs, from nothing. He had made himself a power. To him, the eagle meant that crude, incalculable power of wealth he gloried in. And to Billy Woods, the eagle meant identically the same thing, and I am sorry to say he began to suspect that the eagle was really the audience to whom Miss Hugonin's friends so zealously played. Perhaps the misanthropy of Mr. Woods was not wholly unconnected with the fact that Margaret never looked at him. She'd show him, the fortune hunter. So her eyes never strayed toward him, and her attention never left him. At the end of luncheon, she could have enumerated for you every morsel he had eaten, every glare he had directed toward Kynaston, every beseeching look he had turned to her. Of course he had taken sherry, dry sherry. Hadn't he told her, 4 years ago, it was the first day she'd ever worn the white organdy dotted with purple sprigs, and they sat by the lake so late that afternoon that Frederick R. Woods finally sent for them to come to dinner. Hadn't he told her then that only women and children cared for sweet wines? Of course he had. The villain. Billy, too, had his emotions. To hear that paragon, that queen among women, descant of work done in the slums and of the mysteries of sweatshops, to hear her state offhand that there were 1,750,000 children among the ages of 10 and 15 years employed in the mines and factories of the United States, to hear her discourse of foreign missions as glibly as though she had been born and nurtured in Zambezi land, all these things filled him with an odd sense of alienation. He wasn't worthy of her, and that was a fact. He was only a dumb idiot, and half the words that were falling thick and fast from philanthropic lips about him might as well have been hailstones. For all the benefit he was deriving from them, he couldn't understand half she said. In consequence, he very cordially detested the people who could, especially that grimacing ass Kynaston. Altogether, neither Mr. Woods nor Miss Hugonin got much comfort from their luncheon.